From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. American troops were pelted with potatoes as they left a Kurdish-dominated town in Syria today. The withdrawal of American troops is happening during a ceasefire that paused Turkey's offensive against the Kurds in Syria. That ceasefire is due to end tomorrow. Joining us now is retired Army Major General Paul Eaton. And General, what do you think that the U.S. should do at this point?
I believe that the entire national security apparatus of the United States has got to find their strength, find their spine, confront the president with the nature of the decision that he has made, this terrible decision to abandon our Kurdish allies, and say, Mr. President, we have got to get this thing turned around. And I don't know what he has given our national security apparatus as instructions other than bug out now. Bring in the F-15s to destroy your caches and your logistics centers and go back to Iraq and try to cobble something together there. I'm not sure what this president has done, but the result is chaos on the ground and fractured alliances.
Well, and many are saying that this is very good news for Russia and is going to give it a bigger role in Syria. Is that your sense?
Indeed. Nature doesn't tolerate a vacuum. The Russians... The Iranians, certainly. The Syrians, Bashar al-Assad is going to make hay of this. All the bad actors, all the malign actors have benefited from this president's terrible decision.
What about ISIS? What are your concerns right now about whether ISIS could actually regroup after what has happened?
Jeremy, I believe that, I share this with a lot of people that ISIS is a movement. It's a... It is a political movement as well as a dominant movement. And until you eradicate this cancer 100%, whatever is left over will metastasize. We're watching that. And ISIS is not dead. It is very much a force to be reckoned with.
So what would your advice be at this point to make sure that ISIS does not become a major threat once again to the West?
It would be status quo ante. It would be return to what General Petard did after we had to come back 2011, the leveraging of U.S. air-delivered fires, U.S. ground-delivered fires with proxy forces, reestablish our connections to the Kurds, reestablish safe zones, and essentially start over today what very serious men in uniform did back in 2015 with President Obama, and reestablish centers of security, the oil spot, if you will, and that continues to grow. We cannot allow the vacuum to be filled by malign actors.
Would it even be possible, though, to do that at this point? Would it be safe for U.S. troops to go back into places in Syria that they just pulled out of? And would anybody, including the Kurds, trust them?
That's the point. Absolutely, Jeremy. That is you're absolutely on point for this. And the president has put U.S. forces, U.S. foreign policy at great risk. And I believe that the only prudent measure is to deny malign actors that he has provided an opportunity to influence outcomes here, that we deny it and we reestablish the process. There's a book out there called Imperial Grunts by Robert Kaplan, and it outlines the enormous political influence, the enormous foreign policy influence on outcomes that just a handful of U.S. military can provide. And it picks six or seven different regions of the world. This is one of those regions where a very small number of Americans can fight this war with American strength, with our allies. And we have got to try to return status quo ante that this president has fractured so badly.
Do you think there's any chance of that actually happening, though?
This president is so impetuous. He reacts to strong men, last voice. And with the likes of the two unfortunate graduates of the class of 1986, Mark Esper and Mike Pompeo, These two are not, they don't have the throw weight to do it. It's got to be the uniformed military to present the president just how bad the situation is that he has created and to get this thing back on track. I do not trust the current appointed civilian leadership to get that hard work done.
That is retired Major General Paul Eaton, who served more than 30 years in the U.S. Army, led the training of Iraqi forces after the U.S. invasion in 2003, and is now senior advisor to Vote Vets. Thank you for speaking with us.
Jeremy, absolutely my pleasure. Thank you.
Some of the nation's largest drug companies, including three distributors and a drug maker, have reached a $260 million settlement in Ohio over the opioid crisis. The deal came together earlier this morning and avoids a trial that was slated for today. Joining us now for the latest on this is Nick Castell of WCPN's Idea Stream in Cleveland. Hey, Nick.
Hey, Tanya. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So we should note that this is not part of a global settlement that we've been hearing lots of talks about. This settlement involves two Ohio counties. And what other details do we know?
Right. This can be a little bit confusing because there are so many parties involved in this litigation, more than 2,000 of them. This is a settlement that is narrowly focused between drug companies and these two counties in Ohio. The three major distributors are providing $215 million in cash to the two counties. Another manufacturer, Teva Pharmaceutical, is providing $20 million in cash. They're also making another $25 million available in drug products, including things that could be used for recovery when dealing with people who are facing drug overdoses. So that allows these companies to avoid the trial that was supposed to start today. Mm-hmm. That was essentially the test case for these 2,000 lawsuits against the drug industry being brought by local governments and other parties.
Nick, it also allows them to admit no wrongdoing. It's really early, but do you know how these counties will use this money?
So earlier this month, the counties both announced that they had plans for spending the settlement dollars. They've already received money from some other manufacturers who settled earlier on in this litigation. So Johnson & Johnson, for instance. So the Cuyahoga County wants to spend the money on expanding access to residential drug treatment. They want to hire some positions in county departments that have been affected by the opioid crisis. And one question people will be looking at, too, is how do these counties spend money in the future to prevent future cases of substance use disorder, in the years from now?
Yeah. We know that this opioid crisis has been devastating to not only these communities, but communities throughout the country. I'm really curious, what's been the reaction so far to the settlement there?
Well, local leaders pretty openly said they didn't think this was enough money to really get at the scale of the opioid crisis here in Ohio, but they were willing to accept this money because they can get it pretty much immediately, the $215 million very soon, the money from Teva over the next about year and a half. They want to get money right now so they can start spending it to address a crisis that is still, inflamed all over Ohio right now as we speak. So the immediacy of the money was very important to them.
There's another defendant in this case, Walgreens. It's not part of this settlement. A judge has delayed this Walgreens trial. What do we actually know about what's next for that company?
Right. The plaintiff said that they still have claims that they want to bring against pharmacies who are being sued, both in their capacity as dispensers of these pills, but also in their capacity as distributors. So they want to include Walgreens in that litigation, and they're expecting that they'll prepare for another trial. We don't know when that trial might begin, but it could be sometime next year.
Okay. And as we mentioned earlier, this settlement does not settle those concerns globally. What's happening with talks on the global front in that settlement?
Well, global settlement negotiations have been going on ever since this litigation began. The judge overseeing this case, U.S. District Judge Dan Polster, has pushed for a settlement from the very beginning. He did not want there to be a trial. Negotiations continued through the end of the week last week. There were reports of a possible settlement worth tens of billions of dollars that had been sort of hashed out in principle. What Joe Rice, one of the attorneys for the local government plaintiffs, said today was that four attorneys general last week had presented this possible deal with drug companies, but plaintiffs were not interested in signing on to that agreement, essentially. And so we're still waiting to see whether a global settlement can be reached. Plaintiffs, local government plaintiffs, have said that they're willing to continue working with state AGs and with the companies to try to get to that global settlement.
Absolutely. This is something that I know that you'll be watching, we'll all be watching over the next weeks, months, and really years. This is Nick Castell. He's with WCPN's Idea Stream. Thank you so much, Nick, for your time.
You're welcome.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
The 2020 open enrollment period for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act begins next week in most states, and people are signing up for coverage, even as a lawsuit to undo Obamacare that is supported by the Trump administration works its way through the courts. But as for Republicans who used to campaign on repealing Obamacare, they haven't been saying much about it since Democrats won big in the 2018 midterms on the issue of health care. Joining us now is Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Jeremy.
So, you know, you and I have talked about this a million times, but over the years, the Republicans have been trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act. They've been talking about repealing the Affordable Care Act. This is President Trump speaking in 2016 on the campaign trail.
Together, we're going to deliver real change that once again puts America first. That begins with immediately repealing and replacing the disaster known as Obamacare.
So they've tried. They haven't been able to do it. And they don't seem to be talking that much about it anymore. Did Obamacare survive?
Well, for the moment it has, and Republicans in Congress, still a bit bruised from that unsuccessful fight in 2017, have been talking about other health issues instead. They want to work on lowering drug prices with the Democrats and ending the surprise medical bills that some people with insurance are getting when they get out of network care.
And they've started talking about one of the most popular parts of the Affordable Care Act, which is to protect coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. This is an ad from 2018 in the midterms by then Attorney General of Missouri, now the Senator from Missouri, Josh Hawley. Here he is.
We've got two perfect little boys. Just ask their mama. Earlier this year, we learned our oldest has a rare chronic disease, pre-existing condition. We know what that's like. I'm Josh Hawley. I support forcing insurance companies to cover all pre-existing conditions.
That, of course, is part of Obamacare. Are the Republicans still talking about supporting pre-existing condition coverage?
Oh, absolutely they are. But it would be hard for them to do that without the rest of the Affordable Care Act. They've had a bill or two that professes to do that, and analysts have said that it wouldn't really work. Basically, if you're going to require insurance companies to take sick people, you have to have a mechanism for them to cover healthy people as well. Right now, that mechanism is the subsidies that people get, healthy people get when they buy insurance through the Affordable Care Act.
Now, the Trump administration has not been able to kill Obamacare, but it has weakened it, right? What is the state of the act right now?
Yes. Well, the main thing that's happened to weaken it is Congress and passed and the president signed as part of the tax bill the elimination of the tax penalty for people who don't have health insurance. That was the main thing that insurers thought they needed in order to get healthy people to sign up. It turned out things are doing pretty much okay without it, but it has triggered this lawsuit that we're waiting for that could unravel the whole thing.
And explain that lawsuit. They're suing because if the tax penalty is zero, they say that it's unconstitutional.
That's correct, because in 2012, the Supreme Court upheld the Affordable Care Act based on Congress's taxing power. And these Republican attorneys general say, well, there's no tax anymore, so therefore there's no law. A lower court has ruled that way. We're waiting for the appeals court. So that's a big unknown right now.
OK, and we're going to get to that in a moment. But first, let me bring in Jody Ray, who's director of the organization Florida Covering Kids and Families. That's the Navigator program that helps people in Florida enroll in the Obamacare exchanges. And Jody, you direct that program, which enrolls the most people in federal health care of any state, nearly 1.8 million people enrolled right now. How are things going?
Well, I mean, we consistently still see the demand for access to care and coverage. So, you know, it's tough because initially the enrollment assistance component of the Affordable Care Act was designed to provide in-person assistance, particularly since we want to make sure that we're targeting those hard-to-reach and vulnerable populations. And with the cuts to the Navigator program, we just don't have enough bodies, enough humans to get out there and provide that level of assistance. So I think it still leaves a gap in terms of who has access to that assistance and who's still getting into coverage or remaining in coverage.
Well, and tell me more about the cuts to the Navigator program. What kind of cuts are you facing?
So we in Florida, and I think probably states across the country can speak to this, we literally saw at least an 85% cut to in-person assistance support in the state. And so now my organization here at the University of South Florida is literally the only Navigator entity in the state of Florida. And so it makes it real difficult because we provide year-round enrollment assistance, those qualifying for special enrollment periods, as well as after open enrollment, we still see people who have complicated situations, so complex cases and appeals and data matching issues. And these are things that consumers really struggle with solving on their own, and Navigators are providing that assistance.
Have you been able to find workarounds since you don't have the funding that you used to?
Yeah, it's one of the things that we had to do was, as a result, we had to pull in-person assisters out of about half the counties in Florida. And, you know, Florida's a pretty demographically and geographically diverse state, so it's really sad. But what we're doing to try to at least offset some of that is provide virtual and phone appointments. It's not ideal, but this is what we're doing so that anywhere in the state, there are still people that can access that Navigator assistance. But anyone who's sat down and look at how complicated health plans are and health insurance is, if you're not seeing what we're seeing, it's a struggle.
Julie talked about the Republican-backed Congress getting rid of the individual mandate. What's been the impact of that for you?
Well, I think we've been fortunate in Florida in that the demand for access to care remains high. So I think that contributes to the fact that our enrollment numbers have remained high. I know overall we saw as that mandate rolled out from year one because it got progressively higher, we had people coming in the door that were well aware of the mandate and the fact that it was going to be more expensive for them to be without insurance. Mm-hmm. You know, because they were going to pay the mandate and have nothing to show for it.
And then they wanted insurance as a result.
Yeah. And so the advantage is that people learned, oh, having access to health care is really kind of a wonderful thing. So they, you know, that enrollment process kept growing and growing. But, you know, we still have new people that become eligible for coverage that may not have it. So, you know, if they're not driven by a penalty, like if it's not offset by some other advantage or disadvantage, mm-hmm. they may not sign up.
Now, there's also been more access to so-called skinny plans. Have you seen people opting for those?
Yeah, that's been a little on the scary side, to be honest with you. I've had people come in and bring in those plans. And what I find is that people do not fully comprehend what is in those plans or what they're buying. And so part of the problem is these plans can be like 40 pages long. And they're piecemeal. So I think people don't realize in some ways it's not like insurance in that they don't necessarily have networks. They pay a certain amount for so many visits or whatever the need is. And then they're still going to be on the hook for anything else that the that plan isn't covering, and the providers are not under contract to provide services at those rates.
Jody, do you feel like you have certainty at this point that the Affordable Care Act is here to stay?
Well, I think it would be a stretch to say anything is certain. There are things that have gone on that have surprised me on a daily basis. But I think as we've seen the fight to retain the Affordable Care Act in place that has been sort of at a grassroots level, that has been a positive, you know, a positive result of getting more people in. So now they're fighting for something they don't want to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that tends to be more what the public will do. Don't take something away from me.
Well, and Julie Rovner, what does the polling say about how popular the Affordable Care Act is at this point?
Well, interestingly, it's become more popular since Republicans threatened to take it away. Partly, I think that's the education process. People realized what was in it. They realized for many people who got insurance, as Jody said, that insurance is a good thing to have. For lower income people, there are significant subsidies that makes that insurance affordable. So this is why Republicans are so concerned that health care is still a very large issue in the public's mind and making the Affordable Care Act go away not so popular.
So let's go back to that court case. We're waiting for a decision right now. If the court rules in favor of the state attorneys general and the Trump administration, what would that mean for the Affordable Care Act?
Well, it would just put things in, you know, more disarray and more uncertainty. It would almost certainly not take effect right away. Both sides in the lawsuit have said that they don't want this to be implemented until the Supreme Court has had its say.
Mm-hmm.
There's a question about when, but certainly it would cast a cloud once again over the entire future of the Affordable Care Act. And plus, the Republicans are having a great time now criticizing Democrats for wanting to do what they call socialized medicine. This would put the onus back on the Republicans, put the Republicans back on the defensive when the Democrats say you're trying to get rid of the Affordable Care Act again.
That is Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. And we've also been speaking with Jody Ray, who is the Director of Florida Covering Kids and Families. That's the Navigator program that helps people in Florida enroll in the Obamacare exchanges. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And by the way, the Affordable Care Act was passed in 2010, so it will turn 10 years old next year, and we are still talking about it.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Canadians are voting today in the country's national elections. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's Liberal Party hopes to hang on to a majority, but the race is tight. For more, we're joined by Salima Shivji, who's a senior reporter at the CBC. She's been on the campaign trail and joins us now from Montreal. Salima, welcome.
Thank you.
So this election was Prime Minister Trudeau's to lose, and now it seems like he actually could, right?
Yeah, you know, you talked about it being a really close race. It is really the closest race we've seen up here in a really long time, and virtually no movement to break the deadlock between Justin Trudeau's Liberals and the Conservatives led by Andrew Scheer. And it looks strongly like we'll be getting a minority government. So the whole question is, you know, which of those parties will be in charge of the minority situation? The Prime Minister could stay in power if he's able to get a working situation with some of the other parties on the left. Also interesting is that the leaders of both frontrunner parties, Justin Trudeau and Andrew Scheer, both have terrible approval ratings. So it really feels like voters are kind of looking for something different. Like, we've seen a surge from the Separatist Party in Quebec. It seems like there's a surge of the New Democrats, who appeared really, really low in the polls at the beginning of this race. So it's a funny election. It's an odd one, I'd say. It feels somewhat disjointed as well. There have been some key moments, not a lot of key themes or issues that dominated, but definitely controversy on both sides.
Well, let's talk about the major rival of Justin Trudeau, the Conservative Party leader, Andrew Scheer. If he becomes prime minister, and I know that's a big if, because as you just mentioned, they may have to form a coalition government with another party. But if he becomes leader, how different of a leader would he be for Canada?
very different from Justin Trudeau's Liberals. And you've seen the Trudeau Liberals actually move even more to the left. Andrew Scheer's Conservatives are moving, I would say, more to the right. He is socially more conservative than some of the other leaders. There has been some controversy in terms of his position on things like access to abortion. He personally has said that he is pro-life, but he would not open up the debate. Also, he has promised, Andrew Scheer has promised to get rid of the federal carbon tax, which is one of the main tools that the Trudeau Liberals have been using to fight climate change. And that's really been the central message for the Liberals. You know, we need this huge challenge to fight climate change. And in terms of the Conservatives, their plan, a lot of experts have said it's not quite enough. They have said they would respect Paris targets, but not said how they would do that. So quite different stances from both parties.
It is no secret that President Trump and Prime Minister Trudeau are not best buds. Has the relationship with the U.S. come up in the campaign?
It has. And you know what has come up is the NAFTA, the deal that Justin Trudeau and his Liberals had been trying to get through to get that new deal. Justin Trudeau has been using it a little bit on the campaign trail to sort of say, look, we got this done. We were able to protect some of the things that we were perhaps going to lose in those negotiations. So you should trust us to do more in the next 4 years. Our work isn't finished on some other fronts. It's not been ratified, right? So it did come up on the campaign trail. But as I said, the election didn't feel as much issue-driven as, you know, controversy-driven. We saw the Justin Trudeau photos of him emerging, of him in blackface. That was a bump in the campaign, of course. Mm-hmm. Andrew Scheer had some issues about, you know, being a dual U.S. American citizen and not disclosing it. Interestingly, though, in terms of U.S. Relations, Justin Trudeau did get an endorsement from former U.S. President Barack Obama in this last week. And so they're pretty happy about that on the Liberal camp, as this is such a tight race.
But President Trump has not weighed in, right, on this election?
No, he has not, no.
That is CBC reporter Salima Shivji joining us from Montreal as Canadians go to the polls today. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
The president of Chile has called a state of emergency, saying, quote, "We are at war," after violent protests there over the weekend. The death toll continues to rise after clashes and arson attacks between police and protesters who have flooded the streets after a hike in fares for public transportation. The BBC's Jane Chambers joins us now from the capital of Santiago. And Jane, as I mentioned, we've been hearing this is over public transportation fees, but it's more complicated than that.
Yes, it is. I mean, yes, the initial protests started because of that, but there's a lot more going on. I mean, the protests also about minimum wages, this idea that it's a very expensive country to live in and prices keep going up, and yet the wages stay the same. People are angry about poor pension provisions and how expensive private healthcare is. And there's just this real feeling of inequality, that there are a few very rich people who are benefiting and owners of companies and things, but then lots of very poor people who are struggling. And so when they announced these rises in the metro fares, that was very difficult for people.
Chile is famously known as being Latin America's most stable economy, but it has the highest wealth gap in the world. Tell us what's happening there today.
Well, today it's very difficult because of all this damage that was done to the metro stations. They were closed over the weekend and very few are open now. I mean, just one of the lines is open, so it's really hard for people to get to work. It's been lots of people trying to get on buses, having to walk a really long way to get to the bus stop, talking to people where a journey would take 1 hour. It's now taking them 2 hours. So it's hard, and you've still got troops out on the streets guarding the closed metro stations and at things like petrol stations because of the state of emergency being announced by President Sebastian Piñera. You've got people queuing to get petrol, supermarkets closed, difficult to get food. So it's a difficult situation at the moment.
Yeah, you mentioned the scenes over the weekend. We are looking at pictures of these huge military vehicles facing off against protesters in the streets, lots of fires. It looked really bad.
It was. You have to remember that this is certain areas of Santiago. So, yes, there were tanks, there were water cannons, there was tear gas, and there were very violent protests, lots of looting going on, lots more damage, you know, buses being burnt out, metro stations being trashed, lots of shops, supermarkets being looted, car dealerships. In other areas of Santiago, it was more peaceful. So you'd have peaceful protests with people banging saucepans, which they traditionally did during General Pinochet's military dictatorship. So you had kind of different kinds of protests across the city, but a lot of people criticizing that the military were on the streets. A lot of people don't like that. But on the other hand, there are people telling me that actually it's necessary for security. I mean, there have been criminals going around in lorries targeting places to loot and neighbors. I was talking to a friend who said that in her neighborhood, they'd been out till 3 a.m. making sure that their houses were safe from looters, opportunists coming by to take things.
There's also been criticism about how the president has responded to this. What has been the response from the Chilean government?
Well, President Piñera announced a state of emergency because he wants to bring back calm. He did actually on Saturday afternoon say that they were going to cancel these rises in the metro tickets. So he is trying to calm things down, but a lot of people think that isn't enough. He's talking about the delinquents, the criminals, the need for security. And people say, well, it's not just that. You know, it's people needing to be heard who have got all these grievances about social injustice and inequality. But it is hard for him. One has to understand that there are lots of different groups protesting about lots of different things. So he's talking about the need for dialogue. But the big question at the moment is, who's he going to talk to? Who are the leaders of these groups? So it is hard to kind of find a way forward at the moment.
The BBC's Jane Chambers in Santiago. Jane, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to a story about how real life and a theater classic made it into the latest production from playwright David Henry Hwang. When Hwang saw the 2015 revival of The King and I, there were a few things about it that did not age well for him. The Rodgers and Hammerstein musical is about a white woman modernizing the country Westerners used to call Siam. But the idea of a huge musical with decades of influence on how we as a culture see others spoke to him. And it's one of the things that's at the center of Hwang's latest show, Soft Power, which opened last week at the Public Theater in New York. NPR's Andrew Limbong caught up with the Tony-winning playwright to find out more.
Two things happened on the way to getting Soft Power made. Thing one, playwright David Henry Hwang was stabbed. It was a night shortly after Thanksgiving 2015. It was also possibly a hate crime.
He severed my vertebral artery. I lost about a third of my blood. I walked about 2 blocks to Brooklyn Hospital. And everything turned out fine.
Thing two, President Trump won the 2016 election. And the two together disillusioned Hwang to issues of race, violence, and democracy in America.
It was originally a show that was going to examine China's desire to gain soft power.
Soft power is the ability for a country to spread its ideas through culture instead of, say, military strength.
And now has become a show about an investigation of America's loss of soft power, the decline of American influence throughout the world, and can we gain back our narrative?
Soft Power starts with a Chinese theater producer named Shui Xing approaching DHH, an autobiographical stand-in for David Henry Hwang, to produce a smash hit. This actually happened in real life because David Henry Hwang is a big deal, says Donatella Galella, assistant professor of theater at University of California, Riverside.
He's often considered the foremost Asian American playwright.
He was the first Asian American to get a show on Broadway, M. Butterfly, which he won a Tony Award for in 1988.
He uses a combination of Asian American history intersected often with his own personal history.
And Soft Power, which he wrote with composer Janine Tesori, is no different. It's a little complicated, but the rest of the plot goes like this. To see what a smash hit musical looks like, his onstage counterpart DHH and Shui Xing go and see The King and I together. DHH doesn't love it like he used to. Again, much like real life.
This white woman teaches the king of Siam how to rule his own country?
Oh, she's his advisor.
They argue about the show's message and talk about how theater has the power to shape ideology and how musicals are one of the most effective forms of propaganda out there. Then, on his walk home, DHH is stabbed. That incident kicks off a different show inside the play, a fantasy musical in his head, an alternate take on The King and I, where Shui Xing arrives in the United States amidst the aftermath of the 2016 election and becomes an advisor to a freshly bruised Hillary Clinton.
And I forget what I really should know. I forget that it-
a big, big show.
Just like in The King and I, a traveler comes to a foreign land and romances a leader toward a new set of political ideas. In this case, Shui Xing shows Hillary Clinton a different way, a less democratic, possibly better way of running a country.
There are points to be made. Our system does have weaknesses. And I think in some way the musical functions as, you know, the last temptation of Hillary or the last temptation of DHH.
The temptation being what Shui Xing offers as an alternative to democracy, a more totalitarian state that could have prevented Clinton's loss.
In the wake of the 2016 election, questioning, wow, does democracy even work anymore? Do we still want to fight for it?
You might leave the theater thinking that, obviously, the answer is yes, because the music swells with faith in the American people.
Wise enough.
But theater professor Donatella Galella says the show uses the form of the musical with just enough irony and self-awareness to make the point.
The show is still reminding us that even that is propaganda.
Worthy of trust enough, kind enough, smart enough.
That we are being manipulated to believe this.
That democracy can
lift us up,
lift us up.
Lift us up.
Lift us up. David Heng Huang is asking all these questions about democracy at a prudent time, not just here in the States, but especially in light of the pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong, particularly when cultural exports from cartoons to video games to the NBA struggle with China's seal of approval. The show serves as a reminder as to how firm soft power can be. For Here and Now, I'm Andrew Limbong.
It's been a rough time for high-profile tech startups to go public. WeWork's IPO valuation dropped by more than 80% in recent weeks. The fitness company Peloton saw shares tumble after its IPO in September. And there have been comparisons to the dot-com bubble of 2000. Here's Jim Cramer on CNBC last month.
You have to be skeptical of markets, entire markets, where more and more stocks are valued on something other than earnings. This is what happened during the dot-com crash. You had tons of companies that were trading on eyeballs and page clicks. Needless to say, that suspension of rigor did not end well.
Well, our next guest says we are not headed for another dot-com bubble. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic, where he's written about this. He joins us now. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
Well, first of all, why are we seeing so many comparisons now to the 2000 tech bubble?
There's a lot of similarities. You know, both then and now, you had a lot of consumer tech companies that were spending lavishly on advertising and that couldn't find a profit. Both then and now, you had companies that were bragging about their ability to change the world and bragging about the number of users they were adding on a quarterly basis, even though they were quietly running out of money. And both then and now, you had valuations of heralded tech enterprises that were soaring and then suddenly halving in a matter of weeks. So I don't begrudge people who are seeing the parallels.
But you say that what's happening now is not like the dot-com bubble.
No, it's the exact opposite, in fact. So it's first important to understand exactly what the dot-com bubble was. It was a public mania. In the 1990s, unprofitable internet companies were going public, and then ordinary mom-and-pop investors were piling in. They were buying stock on public stock markets like the NASDAQ and driving up the valuations of these companies that weren't actually businesses. So in the dot-com bubble of 2000, public investors got hosed. But today, it's public investors that are doing the hosing. And lots of companies that are trying to go public are getting slaughtered at the gates. So Peloton, for example, the spinning company, goes public and its stock price plummets. Same for Lyft. It goes public and its stock price immediately plummets. Same for Uber. WeWork's valuation fell so fast that when it announced intentions to go public, its valuation dropped by about 80% in 3 weeks, and it withdrew its public offering in the first place. So it's the exact opposite of the dot-com bubble. It's not public companies that are losing valuations and thus costing public investors trillions of dollars. Rather, it's private companies whose private investors are hoping that they'll get a lot of money on public markets, but public markets are rejecting them in the first place.
Well, and the companies that you just named there, WeWork, Peloton, even you could say Uber and Lyft, are not really tech companies, as you point out. You call this a not-com bubble.
Yes, I say it's not a dot-com bubble. It's a not-com bubble because these companies have tech layers, but they're not entirely tech companies. Peloton sells a bike that exists in the physical world. It weighs a lot of pounds.
Costs a lot of money.
It costs a lot of money. Lyft has and Uber spend a lot of their money on human drivers. WeWork is essentially a real estate business that that's asking for a tech multiple. So these companies are, at the end of the day, based in the physical world of bikes that weigh a lot and humans you have to pay, based on American labor law and real estate that is enormous and costs a lot of money. They're not software companies. They're not pure tech companies. And it turns out that pure tech IPOs have actually been really strong for the last few years. You know, these are companies you probably haven't heard of, like Zscaler and Anaplan. You know, they sell mostly B2B software or cloud services. They're not sexy. They're pure B2B software or cloud service companies. And they, in fact, are much more successful in stock markets than the Lyfts and the Ubers.
But we do remember that in the dot-com bust, it affected the whole economy. Would a failure by these not-com companies pose a risk to the broader economy?
I don't think so. I think these are pretty small companies compared to the entire economy. I mean, you have the U.S. economy, which is, I don't know, like $17 trillion, and you have these companies that have billions of dollars of investments in them, but they're not a huge part of the U.S. economy. They're not a huge part of any sector of the economy, really. I also don't think that a company like Uber or Lyft is going to implode. You could say that with WeWork, there's a concern about WeWork going bankrupt and then what happens to all this commercial real estate that they own in places like New York and Boston. But again, the Atlantic's City Lab has actually done some reporting on this, and it doesn't look like that's going to be much of a catastrophic implosion either. I just don't think that what we're looking like, even though it's sort of exciting and sad to talk about, is anything like a dot-com bubble, which wiped out trillions and trillions of dollars of wealth.
But whatever happens to these companies, the disruption has already happened in the case of Uber and Lyft. In many cases, they have destroyed taxi industries. So if their business model doesn't work out, there's no really going back, is there?
I think that's a fair point. Yeah. I mean, even if the value of Uber might drop from, you know, $100 billion, which it initially got, to $50 billion, to $10 billion, but that doesn't change necessarily the availability of ride hailing. I think that's pretty much here to stay. I think what's most, you know, catastrophic, the biggest impact this is probably going to have is on employees. You know, WeWork is about to fire thousands of people, and Uber and Lyft have fired hundreds, maybe even thousands themselves. You know, the misallocation of capital by private investors is bad for people who work for these companies.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.